The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
George Orwell once wrote that the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms like a cuttlefish spurting out ink. You've probably heard confusing phrases like the trade deficit, the falling dollar, the national debt, unfunded liabilities, and so on, which all sound vague and actuarial and vaguely, well, not me. The reality behind these accounting phrases is perfectly monstrous. When someone, a foreigner say, loans money to the American government, what are they getting in return? Well, they are getting promises of interest payments and eventual repayment of the principal. Where does your government get this money? The government is not a business. It does not generate profits in the free market. So where does it get the money to repay its creditors? Are you beginning to understand that it is not dollars that are being sold, or bonds, or agency debt, or treasuries, or anything like that? Where is your government going to get the money to pay off its creditors? It's not pieces of paper, or contracts, or computer bits that are being sold. There is only one thing that the government has to sell. Governments have only one asset that they can use as collateral. Your leaders are selling you. When China lends $800 billion to your government, what they get in return is a guarantee that $10,000 plus interest will be taken from your family at gunpoint and shipped overseas. When a farmer gets a loan from a bank, he uses his livestock as collateral. It is the milk and meat his cows will produce in the future that he will use to pay off his loan. The bank is buying a share in his cows. You are the livestock that your leaders use as collateral. The leaders that you cheer for and throw parades for and drop balloons behind and donate money to are selling you to Chinese rulers, to the Japanese, to the Nigerians, to South American drug lords with accounts in the Caribbean banking centers, to Russia, to Korea, to Egypt, to Colombia, to Chile, to the Philippines, to Malaysia, and anyone else who is willing to give them a few dollars in return for the blood, sweat, and toil of your future. The flag that you praise and the anthems that you sing and the rulers that you weep and kneel before have as much loyalty to you as a plantation owner had to his slaves. And sadly, plantation slaves had more pride than we do. Plantation slaves did not generally praise their masters for selling them off, for auctioning off the lives, hopes, dreams, and futures of their own little children. We can understand that cattle may lick the hand of the farmer who lowers an axe to its neck, because cattle are dumb beasts that cannot comprehend their real relationship with the farmer and his imminent plans for them. What is our excuse? When we chant, USA, USA, USA. When we cheer and bow and beg and scrape and sing and weep with joy that some new farmer now presides over the wholesale dismantling and sale of our family's futures. When we love with obsessive emptiness the leaders who laugh while they auction us off to every tin pot dictator and stockbroker the world over, what is our excuse? Has our pride been so broken that we lunge with pathetic joy at every new silver-tongued demagogue who pretends to care for us even a tiny little bit? In the future, our children will demand to know why we knelt and cheered as they were sold off on the auctioneer's block. This video and my life's work is my answer to my child. What's yours?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. This is Richard Martin here with the wake-up call. I thought a little bit before playing you that clip, because there is a visual which accompanies it. Unfortunately, you heard some of the background noise, which I expect was a little bit disturbing. I apologize, but I thought that the essence of the clip was worth your attention. He's absolutely right, of course. You are the collateral that is behind the debt that is right now the object of the crisis over the increasing of debt ceiling. You indeed are the fodder that will provide the interest payments that the government needs to pay and the capital repayment. It is your sweat which produces the wherewithal for the government to pick up the dollars and send them off to these far-off countries. And you need to see it in that light. And unfortunately, there isn't enough of it, and there aren't enough of you to go around to pay off all these debts, which never should have been taken in the first place. Now, I'm not going to talk about the debt ceiling. It's a ridiculous game played again by the politicians, which is again why I hate politics. So I'm not going to spend any time talking about that. You're welcome to call in and discuss it, and I will, of course, discuss whatever questions come up on that subject or any other for that matter. But I will say that when the American people discover that they have been taken to the cleaners and that, in fact, they are being used as the fodder to pay off the sins and irresponsibility of the politicians, there will be hell to pay in your country. There will be absolute social Armageddon, because I don't see how the people can contain themselves once they realized how they have been used by the politicians with the simple and sole expedient of getting reelected, because that's really what it's all about. You know, in the past, there certainly have been governments that have got into trouble with debt. But what we are experiencing now is the first truly global sovereign debt crisis. There's actually never been a time in recorded history when virtually all of the governments of the world were drowning in debt all at the same time. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a sovereign debt crisis, and it's never going to end until there is a major global financial collapse. There is simply no way to unwind the colossal web of debt that has been constructed over the last few decades in an orderly fashion. Right now, the European Union and the IMF have been making emergency loans to nations such as Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. But that's only going to buy those countries a few additional months. Giving more loans to nations that are already drowning in red ink may, as they say, kick the can down the road for a little while, but it isn't going to solve anything. And meanwhile, dozens more nations all over the globe are rapidly approaching a day of reckoning. And all of the bailouts that you're hearing about right now are simply delaying the pain. The reality is that when the emergency loans for Greece stop, Greece is going to default. Greece is toast. the game is over for them. You can stick a fork in Greece because it is done. We're living through a tremendous bust. It isn't simply a housing bust. It's the ongoing collapse of the great consumer bubble. The auto industry is on pace to sell 28% fewer new vehicles this year than it did 10 years ago. And 10 years ago was 2001, when the country was in recession. Sales of ovens and stoves are on pace to be at their lowest level since 1992. Home sales over the past year have fallen back to their lowest point since the crisis began. And the big-ticket items are hardly the only problem. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York recently published a jarring report on what it calls discretionary service spending, a category that excludes housing, food, and healthcare, and includes restaurant meals, entertainment, education, and even insurance. Going back decades, such spending had never fallen more than 3% per capita in a recession. In this slump, it is down almost 7% and still hasn't begun to recover. Business executives are only rational to hold back on hiring if they do not know when their customers will fully return. Consumers, for their part, are coping with a sharp loss of wealth and an uncertain future. Retail sales in June were weaker than expected, and consumer confidence fell, causing economists to downgrade their estimates for economic growth yet again. It's a familiar routine by now. Forecasters in Washington and on Wall Street keep saying the recovery's problems are temporary, and then they redefine temporary. What is a permanent fact, though, is that the United States has not produced one single quarter of net growth since 1980. Since 1980, the issuance of debt has exceeded normal organic indigenous growth every single month. During this time, we have seen the technology boom, the internet development, the so-called great economic progress, the convenient excuse for the stock market boom, the housing boom, yet not once was the United States able to create a net profit on its balance sheet. Never mind the recession, the so-called recovery, which never was, and the double dips. We have been in a depression since 2007, and the only reason you don't perhaps know this is because the government spent more than 12% of GDP during that time, when GDP itself has averaged out at about 2%. So of course you didn't feel it. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin. It's the wake-up call, and it's coming to you live from Singapore with the trusted aid of our friends at the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. And as always, it is the moment of truth for you and your questions, which I fully encourage you to pose on the show. Yes, from now until the end of the show, the lines are open, they are toll-free, and they are to be found at 888-874-4888. The number is the same, it doesn't change. Please use it, call up, make your point, make your questions known, and let us hear your rants. Once again, the number, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. You can, of course, as you know, always put through your questions by email to me. The email is open right now and at all times. I will hopefully pick them up and throw them back at you with an answer or with a comment. The email address here at my email is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once more, to the email, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, if you would like to call me privately to discuss your personal situations with me, I would be very happy to take your calls. All it requires for you to do is to make a call to my number in Sarasota, Florida, which comes through directly at no additional expense to you, to Singapore. And the number is area code 941-441-1682. Again, the number to call me, calling me anytime, day or night, because of the huge time difference between us, it really doesn't matter when you call. Just leave a name and a message and a phone number, and I'll call you back. The number is area code 941-441-1682. So look forward to hearing from you one way or another through any one of our different channels. I will be here. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hate to say this, but the United States is a police state. It's not in danger of becoming one. It is one. And quite frankly, it's too late to restore democracy. Well, that's the stark message of Andrew Collins' brave, lucid, and important book, State Power and Democracy, Before and During the Presidency of George W. Bush. Collins comes out swinging like Joe Frazier. Illusions and delusions abound. America as a democracy, much less one that is benevolent, don't stand a chance. The U.S., Collins says, shares all the major attributes of a third world police state, a constant state of emergency in which security always trumps civil liberties, sidestepping of laws by the government, excessive secrecy, the use of preventative detention and holding enemies of the state without filing formal charges, the manufacturing of reasons to go to war. Let me quote from the beginning of the book, and I quote, "The expansion of state power over the course of U.S. history came at the expense of democracy. As state power grew, there developed a disconnect between the theory and practice of democracy in the United States. Ever greater state power meant it became more and more absolute. This resulted in a government that directed its energies and resources towards silencing those who dared question the state's authority." End of quote. Well, some will find Collins more in sorrow than in anger, deadpan delivery, disconcerting or depressing. I think it's refreshingly honest. Notice his use of the past to describe the country. The U.S. is over. It's always been over. Creeping authoritarianism, Collins says, began, quote, "not long after the end of the Revolutionary War, starting with the conquest of North America, and by the start of the 20th century, continuing with the expansionism outside North America." End of quote. Well, that's halfway down the first page. 100 pages in, you'll either be stuffing rags into Molotov cocktails or slitting your wrists. You'll definitely be checking on the expiration date on your passport. Anyone who has read Zinn or Chomsky will be familiar with the long litany of criminality and ultra-violence which exposed the claim of American exceptionalism as a ridiculous hoax. These are all here. The Sedition Acts, the Palmer Raids, and the Red Scare, dirty deals with dictators. Where the book becomes indispensable is its last third, focusing on the Clinton, Bush, and early Obama administrations. This, the author argues, beyond any sane ability to disagree, is when American citizens lost their basic freedoms and civil liberties once and for all. Habeas corpus, an 800-year-old right held by the citizens of all Western nations, gone without so much as a broken window. A president king who orders the execution of American citizens without a trial, nay, without evidence of wrongdoing, with barely a harsh-worded newspaper editorial to complain. For Colin, the USA Patriot Act, passed in haste by a cowed and cowardly Congress that hadn't had time to read it after 9/11, marks the final end of formal democracy in the United States. But if nothing else, sneak into a bookstore, if you still have one in your town, and read pages 142 to 152. Here you will find the most thorough and clear dissection of this horrible law in print. Describing Title I, for example, Colin explains, and I quote, "Due process is not mentioned in the part that grants the president the authority to freeze assets at the start of or even prior to an investigation into terrorism, instead of after it is completed. All property seized can be disposed of according to the president's wishes. There is no legal requirement to have a court order prior to a seizure, creating the possibility that mistakes may be made and in most cases won't be corrected." End of quote. Though he, and I quote again, "a glimmer of hope seemed to appear after President Obama took office," end of quote, Colin shows how the Democratic president, quote, "merely modified police state practices," end of quote. Furthermore, the transitional nature of the brutal authoritarian tactics enacted by Bush into the next presidency indicates that they are not anomalous, but structural. And I quote again, "The Obama administration's position that amnesty should be granted to those who tortured, under Bush, as well as those who authored the torture memos, itself violates national and international law. It also ensures that such policies will likely be repeated." End of quote. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, the name of the book, if you want to write it down, is State Power and Democracy Before and During the Presidency of George W. Bush. And it's by Andrew Colin. That is K-O-L-I-N. All right. Well, we have a caller from Jim in upstate New York who has a question about the 401k and cashing out. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Good morning, Richard. I've been listening to your show quite some time. My question is, I did call up and find out what the 401ks are invested in, my 401k, and I was told that it's in bonds. If you go into the preservation or what it's called, the fixed return, because it's bonds, safe bonds, some treasuries. Yeah, he said they're not municipal bonds. So we said, people I was talking to said, well, we got through 2008 and we didn't have any losses. So I was just wondering, is that the same as like a same safety net as like a treasury money market that you were talking about a little while ago?
No, not necessarily. They really are treasuries, and I very much doubt from the way you describe it that they are treasuries. They're much more likely to be agency bonds and other issues which are not guaranteed by the Treasury. But the problem with general treasuries is that they may have a maturity date which is so far out that you stand to lose a lot of money when interest rates rise because the value of these bonds will collapse. Now, that can't happen in Treasury bills or Treasury money market funds. The maximum maturity is only 90 days. So you really can't lose money with Treasury bills. But with other forms of Treasury paper, you most certainly can. Now, here's my question for you, Jim, which I'm quite perplexed with. You said you had to call the administration to find out what was in your 401k. Well, my two questions, I guess, are to you as follows. First of all, how is it that you haven't received a statement stating what is in your 401k? And much more importantly even than that, how come you didn't know, in as much as you are supposed to make the choices of what to invest in. You're supposed to receive a menu of choices when you first open the 401k account, and you are supposed to check the boxes indicating where you want your money to be placed. Can you give me a quick answer to those two questions, Jim?
Well, one of them, I picked the preservation, and it just says basically you're not going to make a lot of money, but it's supposed to be safe in a nutshell, and they do send you that. It's just pretty difficult to understand what's going on, so I called up, tried to speak to somebody in person, rather than just figure it out for myself. And I told them what I was looking for, preservation more than to put it out there and try to make more money. I want it to be, safe than sorry. That was one of the things.
Okay. Well, then in which case, I'm still not very clear as to what you do have. I don't know whether you check more than one box, so you really do have what sounds like a shopping list of different things, or whether you would like to email me a statement so that I can see for myself what you've got, and then if you'll put a phone number in there, I will call you back and tell you what I think. But I would suggest that route, actually, and anybody else who is in a situation where you're not really clear as to what it is you hold in your 401k, do get in touch with me either on the show here or in private. Again, let me give you my number in case you do want to call me. It's 941-441-1682. Please feel free, call me, and we'll discuss it, and I'll tell you what I think.
And what about... I'm sorry. Yeah. The question was also, I looked into it, they're not making it easy for you just to take your money out. The only thing you could really do is just take out loans. And with all the talk, I don't know, how secure 401ks are.
There are excuses. You can take out money to buy a house, I think, and take out money for severe illnesses. It may be that you need to talk to your administrator again about this and say that, if indeed there is no short-term secure fund, like a treasury bill money market fund, that you would like to do this and find out what they say. But in the first instance, I think I would like it if you would just let me know, send me an email, scan your statement and send it to me by email, and let me see it, and if possible, scan also the menu of choices that they offer you in the fund, Jim, and then I'll get back to you. If you leave me your phone number, I will call you, and I will tell you, I'll give you an opinion as to what I think you should do next.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Nice to know. Good. And so now we are coming to what we call our break, the promo time. So I shall take a break too, and I will be right back.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, a station that doesn't rest until you're informed. Thanks for listening.
Black Agenda Radio is proud to be a part of the Progressive Radio Network. Tune in every Monday afternoon at 4 Eastern Time for news, analysis, and commentary from a Black Left perspective. Black Agenda Radio with me, Glenn Ford, and my co-host Nellie Bailey on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. We're proud to announce that the Progressive Radio Network will be bringing you our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, every Monday afternoon starting June the 6th from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Mark your calendars and save up your questions so you can ask us about possible strategies for your health problems, whether mainstream or complementary and alternative.
We also invite your questions and comments about any area of health care, including politics, economics, ethics, philosophy, and styles of health care.
So remember to tune in every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to the Progressive Radio Network's Prescriptions for Health show.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. A very quick, curt email from Greg Wasick, who says, "Hi, Richard. Now we are hearing that Moody's rating agency suggests that there be no debt ceiling for the U.S. I think this is insane. Can you comment? Thank you for your program, Greg." I think you're right, Greg. It is insane. And there is nothing else to say. Literally nothing else to say. I mean, it is a typical example of yet again the self-indulgence of the American financial network believing that America is utterly exceptional and can do whatever it likes, and there's nobody that can stop it. And they can invent as much money and push it into the system as much as they like, and everybody else has just got to lap it up. Well, I'm sorry, America is about to see its comeuppance, and it won't be pleasant. Thank you, Greg. Thanks for drawing attention to that. You know, the total cost to America of its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, plus the related military operations in Pakistan, is said to exceed $4 trillion. And that is more than three times the sum so far authorized by Congress in the decades since the 9/11 attacks. And this staggering sum emerges from a new study by academics at the Ivy League Brown University that reveals the $1.3 trillion officially appropriated on Capitol Hill is the tip of a spending iceberg. If other Pentagon outlays, interest payments on money borrowed to finance the wars, and the $400 billion estimated to have been spent on the domestic war on terror, so-called, the total cost is already somewhere between $2.3 and $2.7 trillion. And even though the wars are now winding down, add in future military spending, and above all, the cost of looking after veterans, disabled, and otherwise, the total bill would be somewhere between $3.7 and $4.4 trillion. And the report by Brown's Watson Institute for International Studies is not the first time such astronomical figures have been cited. A 2008 study co-authored by the Harvard economist Linda Bilmes and Joseph Stiglitz, a former Nobel economics laureate, reckoned that the wars would end up costing over $3 trillion. The difference is that America's financial position has worsened considerably in the meantime, with a brutal recession and a federal budget deficit running at some $1.5 trillion annually, while healthcare and social security spending is set to soar as the population ages and the baby boomer generation enters retirement. Unlike most of America's previous conflicts, moreover, Iraq and Afghanistan have been financed almost entirely by borrowed money that sooner or later must be repaid. The human misery is commensurate. The report concludes that in all, between 225,000 and 258,000 people have died as a result of the wars. Of that total, U.S. soldiers killed on the battlefield represent a small fraction, some 6,100. The civilian death toll in Iraq is put at 125,000, rather less than some other estimates, and at up to 14,000 in Afghanistan. For Pakistan, no reliable calculation can be made. Even these figures, however, only scratch the surface of the suffering in terms of people injured and maimed, or those who have died from malnutrition or lack of treatment. Nita Crawford, a co-director of the Brown Study, said, "When the fighting stops, the indirect dying continues. Not least, the wars may have created some 7.8 million refugees, roughly equal to the population of Scotland and Wales. What America achieved by such outlays is also more than questionable. Two brutal regimes, those of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, have been overturned, while Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group that carried out 9/11, by all accounts, has been largely destroyed. But in neither Iraq nor Afghanistan is democracy exactly flourishing. While the biggest winner from the Iraq war has been America's arch foe, Iran. Osama bin Laden and his henchmen probably spent the pittance of just $500,000 on organizing the September 2001 attacks, which killed 3,000 people and directly cost the U.S. economy an estimated $50 to $100 billion. In 2003, President George W. Bush proclaimed that the Iraq war would cost $50 to $60 billion. Governments that go to war invariably underestimate the cost, but rarely on such an epic scale. If the Brown Study is correct, the wars that flowed from 9/11 will not only have been the longest in U.S. history. At $4 trillion and counting, their combined cost is approaching that of the Second World War, put at some $4.1 trillion in today's prices by the Congressional Budget Office. How pathetic can you get? Well, let me take, Peter from Rockville, who wants to know the economic impact in correlation with global warming. Peter, hi, how are you?
Thanks for taking my call, Richard. Yes, that is my question. Does it exist in your mind yet? And if so, what is the impact of global warming?
Well, global warming is a sticky one. Global warming started out with the powers that be very skeptical of its effects. Basically, the thinking was that the financial interests were so skewed towards industrial production at the expense of global warming that they obviously wanted to deny its existence. Then the whole thing turned around as the financial interests aligned themselves with the global warming protagonists, and then, of course, global warming became the catch-all and be-all and end-all of our existence. Safe in the hands of the big money interests that by which time had aligned themselves so closely with the global warming that it became heresy to argue with global warming. But there still, nevertheless, remains a huge body of very eminent and prestigious scientists who claim that whether or not global warming is an existent and overwhelming fact of life, the climate of the Earth has always engaged in ups and downs, and until recently we were on a downswing. So whether or not that was the case, it's extremely unlikely that humans were behind it. But all that I have to mention to you, Peter, because I can't myself estimate the global economic impact in terms of global warming, because first of all, I don't think the figures are really available, which is probably why you're asking the question, because the thing hasn't been out long enough for people to make those kind of projections. But secondly, it is obviously difficult to assign figures to a concept which has yet to make itself known on a long-term basis. in order to be able to give figures such as you described. So all
okay,
in all,
well,
the
can
short
I say
answer,
something?
Peter, is that I can't. I'm sorry?
May I like to say something, if I may? Yes, you made a good point there, saying that you were talking about, you were sort of separating human-caused global warming as opposed to just global warming in itself. And I think it's important that brought out, because it doesn't necessarily mean that the global warming that we are experiencing, at least that I think that we're experiencing, is human-caused. And so it's an important point. Now, another thing is that we're talking about, at least some scientists are talking about the Northwest Passage opening up in the Arctic, that we learned about the early explorers, for example, Lewis and Clark and the like, American explorers were looking for the Northwest Passage that joins the waterways, supposedly, that would join the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Go back in our history class.
Hello, Peter. I really am sorry to interrupt you. I don't think I've ever done this before with a caller. But, you know, what you're discussing is way off the kind of topic that we deal with here on the wake-up call. And although it's very interesting, I must confess that I myself don't have information such as you describe. I don't have a personal interest in this either, so I don't follow this issue very clearly. And,
The Northwest Passage would have to do with trade. I'm going to hang up now, but because I'm not getting a good connection with you. But yeah.
Okay, well, we've lost Peter. I'm not quite sure what happened there. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I do apologize about that. I mean, we don't get many calls on the show, and the last thing I want to do is to discourage people from calling in. But there has to be a modicum of relevance, otherwise you're talking to somebody who just won't be able to give you any kind of feedback at all, and I'm certainly not going to pontificate on subjects that I know little or nothing about. So please feel free to call in, and do let me know about your concerns, you know, related to the economy and matters which are of close and important feedback for yourselves, and I'd be glad to help out. One of the reasons, by the way, I don't talk about things like global warming and politics is I really don't want to upset listeners who may have different views to what I have myself, and quite frankly, I'm sure that I do largely preach to the choir when it comes to talking about our current issues, and I really want to be able to just give you information about these issues so that you know that when you're talking to your friends, relatives, associates, whoever it may be, that you've got something to discuss, because I think a lot of people feel frustrated. They know what's going on. They know perfectly well we're in a major worldwide depression, but they really can't bring out any of the facts and figures to support their contention. So they live in this kind of never-never world of perception, but without any kind of fully-fledged reality to flesh it out with. So that's what we're trying to do, and that's what I hope I will continue to try to do. So let me take a question from Roman, a listener, and let me see if I can deal with that. It was an emailed question, and this is what he has to say. Hi, Richard. I've always had this question on my mind and thought you would be the one to answer it. If you borrow $200,000 over 30 years at 7% interest, you end up with a monthly payment of $1,330, which at the end you have paid $279,000 in interest, which is $79,000 more than the actual loan. This payment is all derived through an interesting and complex equation. At the beginning of the loan, you're hardly paying any principal at all and only interest. You only really start paying down the principal by the end of the loan. This all seems a contrived scam created by bankers. It seems to me a fair system of borrowing would be I borrow $200,000 and agree to pay a monthly payment that all goes towards the lent amount plus a reasonably agreed fee to the bank for having lent me the money. Let's say you pay a fee of 10%, then taking the same $1,330, you pay $1,197 towards the loan and $133 in your monthly fee. In the end, you pay down your loan in just about 14 years and pay a total of $18,620 in fees for the bank lending you money. Isn't this a more fair and reasonable system? So who came up with this mortgage equation? Why is it that everyone follows this system? Is there a real reason for it? If you answer it on the air, please tell me the date and I will download the show and listen to your answer. Thanks. Roman. Well, when you make a mortgage payment, Roman, on a 30-year loan, or any loan term for that matter, the bank is simply charging you the interest that is due on the principal amount owed. For example, on the first payment of a loan amount of $100,000 with an interest rate of 5%, the interest owed is calculating by multiplying the interest rate, 5% or 0.05, by the loan amount, $100,000, and dividing it by 12 months. The interest owed for that month would be $416.67. Now, whether you have a 30-year, 40, 25, 20, 15, or 10-year mortgage loan, the amount of interest due on a balance of $100,000 at 5% will always be $416.67. The difference between those mortgage types, i.e. 10, 15, 30-year terms, is the amount that you are forced to pay to principal so that the loan is paid in full in the time allotted in the contract. Naturally, on a 15-year mortgage, you will see a lot more go to the principal with each payment. Hypothetically, if you pay that $416.67 along with a payment to principal of $1,000, then for your next payment, you will only have to pay the interest due on $99,000 at 5% or $412.50. Then, if you wanted to bring your mortgage balance to $98,000, you would only have to pay $1,412.50. What if the interest was fixed but the payments were not, as you hypothesize? Such a mortgage product could exist, because the bank would still earn the interest that is due each month. But I think there is a small amount of the population that would want to start with the higher payment. Let's use the 30-year mortgage of $100,000 at 5% again. If you were to pay off this mortgage over 360 months, or 30 years, with equal principal payments each month, you would have to pay $277.78 to the principal balance each month. Again, the first month, you would pay 5% interest on the full $100,000, which would equal $416.67. That's $100,000 times 0.05 divided by 12. Your first month payment would be $277.78 plus $416.67 or $694.45. The second month, you would owe less interest and your payment would go down to $693.95, and as you paid the principal down by $277.78 month after month, your monthly payments would decrease every month until the mortgage is paid in full in 30 years. Your last payment would be $277.78. The way it really works is that with a traditional 30-year fixed mortgage today, the payments are fixed. What this means for you is a lower payment at first, with much more of your payment going towards the interest. Instead of starting out at $694.45 and having your payments go down each month, you start with a payment of $536.82 and end with that same payment in 30 years. It's great that you have a low payment, but it's kind of a bummer that you're not putting hardly anything towards the principal balance at the start. In fact, it would take a whole 16 years before the amount of your payments applied to interest and principal are split 50-50. Roman, it's not that the bank is trying to take advantage of you. They're simply collecting the amount of interest that is due, which comes down to simple math. In fact, the current 30-year fixed fully amortizing mortgage was designed to make buying a home more affordable for you and to make budgeting easier. However, you don't have to like it, and there is a strategy for making those early mortgage statements more tolerable. Get a 25, 20, 15, or 10-year fixed mortgage, or pay more than is due each month. Okay, I admit, I'm being a bit sarcastic, but nerves can be jerked sometimes. Just because you signed up for a 30-year mortgage doesn't mean that you can't pay it off sooner by paying a little extra to the principal each month, unless you have a prepayment penalty, and in that case your lender is a way bigger jerk than I am. I'm not going to do the math, you've done enough of that already, but if you can make one extra payment per year, then you can pay off your 30-year mortgage around 7 years faster. The 30-year mortgage is really not a scam. If bankers made more money by front-loading the interest, then they would want everybody to do a 30-year mortgage and offer a lower interest rate than the 15-year or 10-year mortgage. That's not actually the case, as they offer interest rates that are substantially lower on 15- and 10-year mortgages. They prefer the shorter-term mortgages, as they free up money more quickly and aren't subjected to the risk of rising interest rates. Also, borrowers that pay down their mortgages faster are likely to default. So I guess the moral of the story is just to pay down the mortgage as quickly as possible. Okay, I hope that's answered your question, Roman. Let's try another one. Let's see what we get here. Al Berry wrote in saying, Dear Richard, 1. S&P 500 Index. Would you go long, short, or stay out of it right now? 2. Would you keep all your money in short-term 30-day or 90-day bills, or would you diversify a little into other currencies and some commodities? 3. Will the deflationary crash be relatively quick followed by a rapid inflation, or will deflation stay with us for years? 4. Once the deflationary crash starts, will interest rates on bonds spike up? If so, which bonds will crash? Thank you, Al Berry. Lots of information there to divulge. Al, let me go very quickly. I would go short on the S&P right now. Yes, short. As short as you can. I would keep my money in T-bills, and I wouldn't diversify into other currencies right now. I think the dollar is going to rally. I think you are going to see a much stronger dollar in 6 months or a year, and what happens then will depend on what's going on at that time. Check back at that point, Al, for further information. I think we are seeing a deflationary move down. Crash, I'm not so sure. Maybe, maybe not. But it is deflationary. There is no question about that in my mind. And it will stay with us for a while and then possibly be followed by inflation. Again, I don't know how this will pan out. We are in untrodden waters here, so I feel that we must play it as it comes. But right now, it's deflation, a stronger dollar, and short-term T-bills. Hope that's answered your question, Al. Rosemary Otika wrote in saying, Hi Richard, thanks so much for your program. How about Iceland? Did they do the right thing by not paying the banks, or did I misunderstand? Anyone else in Europe doing okay? Sweden? Norway? Well, yes, Sweden and Norway, you've, I think, got the best of the bunch there. Maybe Denmark too, but certainly Norway and Sweden are doing fine. And Norway, of course, in terms of its oil, is being helped along rather much, but certainly Iceland did the right thing, Rosemary. It just told the bankers to stuff it. And the bankers made the wrong decisions to start with, so the bankers should take the brunt of the fall. That is not the opinion of the Europeans. It's not the opinion of Mr. Bernanke or the other people in power in government financial circles. They want to help the banks out as much as possible. I think that's a ridiculous idea. I think the banks that made the mistakes should take the druthers, and I think that that should happen in Ireland, in the countries that made the injudicious loans to Greece, such as France and Germany. And I do think that Iceland is the model example of where the indebted countries should go. So that's your answer to that question, Rosemary. Thank you very much for it. Steve Kruger says, Richard, it would not shock me to find out that our hidden government, the military-industrial complex, is about 1,000 years ahead of anything that they let us see. Look at the space shuttle. Would they close that program, leaving no way to service satellites or replace old ones? The 3D printer replicator is amassing. I'd be willing to bet that they have already found artificial intelligence. By the way, Steve is referring to an email that I sent out to my distribution list about the 3D printer, which is an extraordinary device, which many of you might like to follow up by going to Google and Googling 3D printer. Let me finish off with Steve's letter here. Very little that helps mankind gets past these bastards. If they can't weaponize it, the idea is passed over. Jane was right when she said, it's a jungle out there. Steve Kruger. Very good, Steve. Thank you. I knew I could always rely on you to shake up the atmosphere a little bit around here. Okay, Nick Patterson wrote in saying, hi, Richard. Just a quick note to say that I really enjoy your show. I am a non-American living in Europe, but I still find your show relevant and highly informative. I thought that last Monday's show was one of the best, especially your analogy of how money printing leads to inflation and eventual currency collapse. The scenario, of course, changes somewhat if said money printer has to back up his currency with gold, the gold standard, and would therefore be limited as to how much money he can print by the size of his gold reserve. This would be a natural barrier to inflation, thereby preventing debasement of the currency and gives real value to the paper money in circulation. Anyway, keep up the good work, and I look forward to hearing many more of your podcasts. Regards, Nick Patterson. Well, just a quick follow-up to my discussion of Europe last week. The Greek deputy finance minister just announced that Athens would fall far short of the planned asset sales, and the Greek prime minister has published an open letter to Eurogroup chairman Juncker warning that Greece has done all that it could. It seems that Greece is placing an ultimatum on Europe, and this for a very simple reason. The end game for the EMU, that's the European Monetary Union, is approaching much faster than most investors had expected. In his letter, Papandreou boldly stated that Greece is no longer prepared to make further concessions and will thus blow up Europe's financial system if it is subjected to any more pressure. In other words, it is now time for all additional concessions to come from the side of Germany, the European Central Bank, and the European Union. The willingness of Papandreou to speak so boldly is hugely important, since it marks a recognition by the debtors that they now have the whip hand in these negotiations. The Greeks and Irish, for some reason, failed to realize their power last year, but they do now. This transforms the balance of power in the negotiations, and as a result, Germany and the ECB have reached the moment of truth. Either they comply with the debtor countries' demands, or they abandon the euro. This ultimatum probably helps explain why the European currency has been so weak and why it should be heading even lower. There will yet be another emergency meeting next Thursday. The crisis is coming to the final innings. Will Germany and the ECB finance Greece, or will they accept and apply the grim reality, which is that Europe, as we know it, is dead? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've said my piece. The Dow Jones is now currently down 150 points. The European markets are very weak. And so if any of you have any doubt as to why this is happening, what I just told you should give you more than a few of the answers. The situation is very grave indeed. And with that, I must tell you that again, we are coming to the end of another show. I hope it has been informative and interesting, and for the people interested in the mortgage question, you are going to probably have to listen to my explanation all over again because it was a little bit complicated. But in any case, I shall be back with you on Friday at the prescribed moment and in the prescribed manner. This is Richard Martin wishing you a wonderful week ahead. See you soon. Take care and bye-bye.